Hello and welcome to the McHale Report podcast. My name is John McHale, Group Editorial Director for Military Embedded Systems and host for today's event. This podcast is sponsored by Pentek, a leading manufacturer of embedded boards and recording systems serving the defense market. As one of the original COTS vendors, Pentek has been involved in developing open architecture standards for almost 20 years. The company is committed to the support and development of modular open architectures as seen with key contributions to VITA, PICMEG, and now the SOSA standard. Pentek is an active member with leadership roles in the SOSA Consortium Technical and Business Working Groups. To find out more about Pentek and SOSA, visit www.pentek.com/SOSA, S-O-S-A. And now for our guest today, George Hsu, CTO, founder, and board member of P&I Sensor Corp. And today we're going to discuss technology for helping soldiers navigate in GPS-denied environments. It'll be a good theme as we enter the AUSA Week, Association of the U.S. Army, although it's virtual this year, but we still want to focus on Army content. And George is going to take us on how we're going to get through those battlefield situations where GPS is being denied. So before we get started, I'm going to ask George to just kind of give a brief description of the responsibility with P&I Corp, George, and your background in the defense industry.
Yeah. Hi, John. Thank you for the opportunity. It's really a pleasure to be on. So basically, I'm the original founder of P&I almost 30 plus years ago. We started off in electronic compassing. So certainly a key piece of any sort of tracking and navigation technology. My daily role is as chief technology officer. And I think that the main function of a good CTO is to try to allocate resources to work in the most meaningful manner on relevant problems. And what we found to have a really high relevancy is GPS denied tracking, infrastructureless tracking. So you know, being in a battlefield situation and having a completely self-contained, self-enclosed device that can provide location primarily at this point to work in conjunction with GPS. So whenever GPS becomes denied, you still have positioning information for long periods of time. And then subsequent to that, to have something completely self-contained that would never rely on GPS. And so I think that these are the kinds of problems that we've heard over and over again over the last several decades as to being sort of top on the wish list of the military customers that we engage with. And we have from the start, from the very start actually, been working with the military. Our company was actually founded on one of the first SBIR contracts, and we work with the Army Topographic Laboratories out of Fort Belvoir, and we got both a phase one and a phase two contract, and that's when we really perfected our magnetic sensing technology.
So the Army was kind of your first customer in many ways.
They are the first customer. They're our foundational customer. So we know them quite well.
And so it has your technologies aimed at helping warfighters, soldiers, you know, sailors, airmen, et cetera, navigate GPS denied environments. What are the big technical obstacles that make this difficult to solve from an Army perspective?
So we're all familiar with, tactical and navigational grade inertial sensing units or inertial navigation devices. So clearly there is technology that exists that can do some of these things on vehicular or weapons platforms. But the soldier is sort of a different beast for a lot of reasons. Number one, I think he's already got a lot of kit and gear that weighs a ton. And so you know, lugging it around something really big with a really, really big battery is probably not necessarily something that they would want to do. I remember reading an article about this great body armor and how soldiers didn't really wear it because it was way too hot in Iraq. So with all the best intentions and you think that, protecting life and limb, something like that would be something that you would want to wear all the time. At least I would if I were in that situation. You know, there is something different that happens, you know, when the rubber hits the road. And so, yeah. So aside from, you know, the issue of size and power consumption, there is the issue of cost. You know, having something that's tens of thousands of dollars, you know, just not viable for large scale deployment, you know, to individual Army personnel. I think the other thing is that that probably people don't really know is that you know, you don't really think about this all that much, is the fact that soldiers have very different ways that they move than, say, a cruise missile or a vehicle. And so, you know, they'll tend to, you know, dive, duck, run, and a lot of other kinds of dynamic motions that even today's tactical and navigation grade gyroscopes and inertial sensing or inertial navigation systems would have a harder time dealing with. So it's not just the fact that there's a physics of size, you know, weight, power, and the physics of cost, but there's also the physics of the actual motion itself. So if you know, were to strap one of these large systems on a soldier or put it in a backpack, it would actually not necessarily do the same job it would on a vehicular platform. So those are some of the challenges. The other challenge is that we actually, as a company, came in from the consumer handset market. You know, we solve some of these tracking problems for the mobile phone market, and so we started with really, really bad sensors, you know, that were really cheap and you know, didn't perform very well, and you know, made it work to the extent possible for that market. And so we sort of had a very different mindset. But the one thing about that market is, unlike a battlefield, you know, you have really good maps. You can, you know, do Wi-Fi fingerprinting. You can do, you know, sort of simultaneous location and mapping. You can do, you know, beacons. And so a lot of the stuff where, you know, you can rely on the environment or you know, partners in the ecosystem, like, you know, retailers, stores, you know, putting beacons out in their shopping aisles. You really don't have that, you know, in a hostile environment. And so I think primarily in a battlefield situation, you know, you're really going cold. You really don't know anything. And you know, especially now, I think with more the urban warfare theater, it's only going to be, you know, worse. And so you have to deal with, you know, going in and locating and tracking and navigating with no aid. And so that's where I think the trick is.
You mentioned the motion, tracking the motion, and how it's tougher to do that with a human being's motion as opposed to a vehicle, like a ground vehicle or even an aircraft. They're more predictable.
Yes. A lot of these filtering algorithms that, you know, these common filters that work on these inertial navigation systems, you know, presume that you can nicely model the kinds of motions that the platform would see. And it turns out that humans are the one platform, a soldier is difficult to model because it's very herky jerky, and it's not, you know, it's just not the same thing as you know, a large, you know, say a fighter jet or something like that.
And, you know, you talked earlier in the, when you started discussing the different challenges, you mentioned battery power and how we want to get that smaller and smaller. I think if you guys come up with a way to make battery power last for a week and be holding the pound of your palm of your hand, you guys will be a multi billion dollar company. So I don't know if you have that in the R&D lab right now, but what are you guys doing in terms of managing power consumption in your devices?
Certainly something like that is on the roadmap. So for sure, it is in our sweet spot. As far as power consumption, you know, as I mentioned before, our original customer, aside from the Army, was the mobile handset market. And so you have billions of dollars of R&D plus the you know, the sheer size of that market driving development of sensors that are, you know, relatively inexpensive, you know, a full inertial sensor set for, you know, say $2 or less. And also, they are very sensitive to power as well, you know? And so, so our approach has never been to take the highest performance, you know, gyros and Excels and, you know, make them smaller and cheaper. Ours was always, you know, sort of like, what can you do with the crappiest, lowest power, cheapest sensors possible? And that's how we've sort of developed our algorithmic approach for tracking. And so, yes, actually.
Yeah, because the soldiers are being dealt with the most state-of-the-art stuff all the time. They're in the battlefield. Yeah. They get to deal with it, so.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of interesting because if on the surface of it, you look at some of these sensors and you say there's no way this thing can track you for, you know, like half a day, let alone, there's no way that this could actually track you for even like, you know, 30 seconds, let alone half a day. But actually, if you do combine some of the algorithms and make the sensors really work in concert with each other, you can get really, really good, GPS denied tracking for up to an hour now with the sort of commercial automotive grade sensors that we're working with. And those sensors, you know, sort of as par, they already are sort of drawing less than, 3 milliwatts. You know, so that's I think like about 1,000 or 5,000 times less power than some of the more traditional fiber optic gyro systems, you know, where they're talking about, you know, 75 watts or something like that. So it's our approach. Our fundamental approach is to start with the small, the cheap, the low power, and then make it work with the cleverness that is inherent in the algorithms that we develop.
In addition to power, a question I often ask, because it's one of the most common challenges, is managing thermals, managing power, but also the trend towards leveraging artificial intelligence and machine learning in the development or in deployment of technology. Do you guys use that at all in your sensor system?
Yeah, I don't want to get too much in the weeds in terms of the technology, but all these sensors that we use, the magnetic sensor, the gyroscope, and the Excel, they produce what we call time series data. So basically, it's a stream of outputs that changes over time. And so if you look at them, they're basically little graphs, squiggly lines. And so, but when a soldier, you know, takes a step in a direction, these three sensors will have their graphs change. And when you look at the pattern, you know, you can identify, oh, that was a step and this was the direction. And, did the guy crawl or, you know, whatever it is. And so these classification problems are exactly what AI is good at. And so, you develop sort of, how is the soldier, moving, how far did he go, what direction, and, you know, what's your confidence? And those are the things that is, you know, squarely AI.
In terms of the Army itself, the end user, you guys are doing a lot, you're providing a lot of tech. What else can the Army, and even other areas, if you want to expand it, so into Navy or Marine Corps, or even the Air Force, what can they do to improve sensor navigation? Is there a roadmap that you guys have looked at with them, or what's going on there?
Yeah, you know, we put in some, proposals to sort of give them a slightly different perspective on this sort of age-old problem. And we certainly want to continue working with the right PEOs to do other developments along these lines. But the one thing I would say is that, some of these technologies, and especially the magnetic sensor technology, has traditionally been, you know, both perfect and really horrible. You know, they're perfect at, you know, pointing in a direction for a long period of time, like forever. But they can be perturbed by the environment. They're really easy to mess up. So that challenge of making it work for what it's good at without suffering the deficiencies of what it's weak at is sort of has caused a lot of the agencies, you know, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, to write them off as a potential solution. And so I would say that, one thing that would be beneficial is to take a fresh look at something that's been around. You know, we've heard a lot about, you know, the desire to have a non-magnetic magnetic sensor. And you know, what we've spent is 30 odd years basically making that, you know, through the smarts, and especially in combination with the gyro and accelerometer, is to create a perfect magnetic sensor, you know, one that does its job without suffering any of the downsides of environmental influence and the other things that you know, have made them be written off in the past.
So the perfect magnetic sensor, is that going to be the name for it when you come up with it, or are you going to have something?
Yeah, you know, maybe I need to pay you a royalty here.
You said it. But, you know, so the perfect magnetic sensor is something you're working on down the road. Would you, now you've been doing this for, you know, 30 years, what you told me another time. But is that the next game changer, the perfect magnetic sensor, or is there something else out there? So this, I always ask this of CTOs, predict the future.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, that's a great question. Yeah, you know, I think that, yeah, the perfect magnetic sensor is sort of the future, you know, because I can tell you right now that, you know, that there, you know, fiber optic gyros right now, in conjunction with an accelerometer, can already give you latitude. So, you know, by putting it in north seeking mode, you basically figure out the direction of the rotation of the Earth. And then you can tell by the gravity sensor, the accelerometer, you can get a pretty precise latitude. And the thing that you cannot do right now is get longitude. Well, you could get longitude if you had this perfect magnetic sensor, because, you know, the geographic north that the axis of the Earth spins upon, and the magnetic north, which is, you know, from the magnetic materials in the crust or the magma of the Earth, they have slightly different directions. And so if you can measure the magnetic field without the influence of the environmental things like cars and buildings and some of the other stuff, you can also get longitude. So with a completely self-contained unit, something that could fit in a pocket, or you know, for sure, you know, maybe the size of a carton of cigarettes. Sorry, I didn't mean to bring in anything too evil here, but yes. So something small and completely portable could give you latitude and longitude with no other infrastructure technologies whatsoever.
Well, that means the old James Bond guys who used to smoke could have had their cigarette lighter was really a secret perfect magnetic sensor.
And, oh, well, it was a gun too. So yeah, no, you're right.
Multifunctionality is what we're always trying to add to our military technology. So how far is something like that away? The perfect magnetic sensor. Is that a five-year?
Well, you know, these are some of the things that we've been basically writing proposals for. So I think it's personally, I think it's, yeah, two years out probably. You know, something that could be fieldable, you know, in some volume, maybe tens of thousands. I think that that's completely feasible. I think initially it might be a little bit more expensive, but you know, what we have is a confluence of other you know, technologies that are supporting technologies that will come down in price, you know, because of you know, the mobile phone and automotive markets, and so like processing power. I was just looking at a processor from STMicrosystems last week, and it's basically a combination of an A7 sort of, you know, call it OS class sensor that can run Linux. And then it's basically on chip along with an M4, which is a you know, embedded processor. And these two work by hardware completely in concert with each other. So, you know, that kind of processing power in a system like this, you know, would make the kinds of algorithms we would need to run that would have been inconceivable 2 years ago, completely doable, you know, now.
That is pretty cool technology.
It's pretty cool stuff. And if one A7 core and one M4 core is not enough, you can get, you know, two and two all in one chip. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, the processing power and a lot of, you mentioned automotive markets kind of drive down the cost of military technology today. It's kind of just complete opposite of what it was 30, 40 years ago where military drove the markets. But now it's the same thing with radar. Car radars are driving down the price and adding innovation to military radars. And kind of, I think it's happening what you're saying with the sensor technology as well.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I actually sit on the position, navigation, and timing technical advisory committee for SEMI, and you know, they just did a joint development funding effort with ARL, we heard the ARL representatives come and say, hey, you know, the paradigm has shifted. It used to be that, you know, that the military would drive the technology roadmap, but now it's the cell phone market and the automotive market. And so, you know, finding that right balance it's still driven by the high volume stuff, but you know, now you can sort of, you know, bend the edges a little bit back towards where the mission is super critical.
And for those of you who don't know, Army Research Lab is what ARL stands for. Thank you, George, for today. That brings us up to our time limit, but this was a really cool podcast. I learned a lot today that I didn't know about some of the tech being designed, and I definitely didn't know what the perfect magnetic sensor was going
to
look like.
Yeah, well, that is our charter, to make that thing work, and it's going to go to the moon next year, so we're really excited about that, too.
Also like to thank our sponsor, Pentek, a leading manufacturer of embedded boards and recording systems serving the defense market. As one of the original COTS vendors, Pentek has been involved in developing open architecture standards for almost 20 years. Companies committed to the support and development of modular open standard architecture has seen with key contributions of VITA, PICNEG, and now the SOSA standard. Pentek is an active member with leadership roles in the SOSA consortium, technical and business working groups. To find out more about Pentek and SOSA, visit www.pentek.com/SOSA. Thanks to all of you for listening to today's McHale Report podcast. Look forward to seeing you in future books.